This episode is brought to you by Saks.com. At Saks.com, it's easy to find your new vibe. Dive into the Western trend with gold cowboy boots from Staud, or go full 90s throwback with platforms from Prada. You can shop for everything on your agenda, whether it's a breezy Zimmermann dress for a garden party or a bright Chloe blazer for brunch. Find inspiration for your new vibe every day at Saks.com.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome to the first episode of a channel that I still have to name, but thank you for agreeing to talk to me about your book. Can I ask you to introduce yourself?
Absolutely. My name is Leigh-Claire LaBerge from Virginia. So I go by my first and middle names. So it's Leigh-Claire. I am a professor of English at the City University of New York, the BMCC campus. I study in general, like my, you know, sort of long research profile would be connections between the economy and different cultural forms at different particular moments. So I've written about finance and the rise of postmodern literature in the 1970s and 80s in the US. I've written about contemporary art and the problem of pervasive wagelessness of many cultural workers. That book also had a chapter on the figure of the unpaid animal as a kind of artist. And that gave me some of the ideas for this book, which is called Marx for Cats, which is also about connections between the economy and culture, but in a very sort of different scale, different approach. But I certainly see the themes going through my research.
So I read your introduction and I read about Mitten, your kitten, and maybe like a brief snapshot of what went behind the book. But can you tell us the story of, of Marx for Cats?
Sure. So my last book was called Wages Against Artwork. It's the one I mentioned about unpaid artists, unpaid cultural workers. And as a result of that book, I got asked to speak to a lot of different arts audiences. I got asked to speak at art schools and talk to artists. And many of them are very motivated by and read a lot of critical theory, economic theory, Marxist theory, aesthetic theory. But they sort of develop rather kind of idiosyncratic, we might say, concepts and of terms like the commodity, aesthetic, production, finance, money, alienation. And so a few artist friends of mine encouraged me to make some videos where I would explain basic terms of Marxist political economy for artists. And, you know, I'm a teacher, I'm a professor. I said, I just can't make any more pedagogical video. It's just too much. I can't listen to my own voice. It's too boring. And they said, well, what if you weren't explaining them to students, but to a group of cats? And so we made these videos. They were quite popular. The cats loved the material, particularly Marx's writing on the class struggles in France. I mean, they just went crazy. And viewers can check these out. They're up on marxforcats.com. They're up on Vimeo. And after seeing these videos, some publishers reached out to me to ask me if they could become a book. And my immediate response was like, I have no idea. I doubt it. You know, it's just me explaining the commodity form to a group of cats. And then, you know, the idea of sticking with an academic project that I had such sort of like unbridled fun with. I mean, it was a very joyous project. I love to write, but this project was just, it was more fun. I just started remembering these random feline terms that had to do with economics. So wildcat strike, for example, it's a kind of strike not supported by a union. I mean, we still call them wildcat strikes, but the term is of early 20th century origin. Or wildcat banking. It's a form of deregulated banking. It's very popular in the Midwest U.S. in the 1840s through 1870s, 80s. And, you know, then, of course, I thought that's just domestic cats. A wildcat is a, you know, a feral domestic cat or like a small lynx or something. But then I started thinking, like, oh, my God, the Black Panthers. You know, here's this radical Black organization calling for an abolition of capitalism, claiming that capitalism is a fundamentally racist order. And they name themselves after a panther, but that's a cat. You know, they name themselves after cats. And this is right when the pandemic was setting in. So this was early 2020. And very soon I just sort of found myself trapped in this weird Marxist cat universe where I would think of every economic moment I could imagine and wonder if there was a cat presence there. And there was, and I mean, there were in so many. And so that's how the book sort of started to take shape.
Yeah, I also read that, did I read it or did I just imagine your cat mitten came to your dreams?
That was at the end of the book.
Yeah.
At the end of the book, yes. I mean, the, you know, the book is, it's many things. It's a satire of academic writing, particularly sort of like the Marxist male monograph, you know, or anarchist male monograph, something like Debt, the First 5,000 Years, or passages from antiquity to feudalism, or the long 20th century, this sort of huge long durée of a time period. So in a sense, it plays with that, but it also is a serious question. What should the relationship between Marxists or people interested in radical political economy and animals be? And the mitten was my cat for many years. He passed away in 2016. But yeah, 2 years later, he came to me in a dream and sort of told me to get with it, like to really start to think about animals in a more critical and a less sort of sentimental register. And so he did in part motivate the book in a way that's the, you know, that feels very nice. That's very, very sweet. Although I do have to say that one of the things that I have learned since in the process of writing the book and as a result of writing the book is that I don't think I would ever have a pet again. And I certainly would never have a cat again. So it's bittersweet, but it's a dialectic. And this is a book about dialectics.
So what was the writing process like? I mean, there is, of course, you're bringing art and theory, and I'm guessing that there was a lot of collaboration between artists, illustrators, and your research, right?
Yes.
So what was the process like? How did you bring all of this together?
Yes.
Excuse me for a second.
Sure.
Yeah.
So the book has a quite long historical time scope, right? It starts in the ninth century. The beginning of the book starts in the ninth century, and it ends with the sort of first election of Donald Trump and the pandemic. So it's about 1,200 years. So to do that kind of history, I really needed to have a model. And of course, I just said this was a satire of sort of male Marxist long durée economic histories. But the reason I can satire them is, and do so with a lot of fidelity, is that I love reading them. So I did have the sort of historical narrative in place. And, you know, Marx himself says the history of capitalism begins with feudalism. Therefore, any investigation into capitalism starts in the Middle Ages. And so that's where I started. That was the hardest and most difficult for me to write about because it was so far out of my sort of purview as a sort of literary historian and critical theorist. And then the closer we got to the 19th and 20th century, the more comfortable I became. But I relied on, you know, some really wonderful scholarship. And in the acknowledgments, I cite a few books that I had also cited, you know, in a footnote in the text, but I say these are books that really gave me a bold vision of what a writing process could be in terms of an academic book. And two of them, as you suggest with your question, were very visual books. So Klaus Tewellite's 1977 Male Fantasies, you know, sort of this incredible survey of the role of masculine aggression and masculine fantasy in bourgeois capitalism leading up to the Third Reich. But the images of art, of culture, of literature that he uses, I mean, sometimes there's a direct relation to the text, and sometimes it's more montage-like. And so I really wanted to follow that. So the book has about 100 images, a few of which I commissioned, but many of which I didn't. I found in archives. The amazing thing about writing about the Middle Ages is the visual record. And, you know, the book, the subtitle of the book is A Radical Bestiary. And a bestiary is a book of animals that is illustrated. And I use some of these illustrations, but that was another one of my models was the bestiary, was a book that tells stories about animals through pictures and text. Sometimes there's a direct relationship. Sometimes there's an associative relationship. I like the feeling as a reader that that engenders. There's a sort of imaginative and playful space. Another book that I have been so moved by is Sunara Taylor's book Beasts of Burden, which is about disability and animal studies and animal rights. And she herself is a painter, and she used her own paintings to illustrate this book. And you know, her book Beasts of Burden and Male Fantasies, they're capacious at the level of the imagination. And I read so many academic books that are so smart, so well argued, so well researched, but I wouldn't necessarily say they go on flights of fancy, you know? And this whole book is a kind of like flight of fancy. Like if we follow hundreds of thousands of cat references through 1200 years, where do we arrive in terms of the relationship between what the economy is and what an animal can embody and signify, and what might be other possible permutations of that. So in a sense, it's a very speculative book, which just made it such a delight to write. You know, it was really a fun book to write. And also, who doesn't want to look at cat pictures all day? I mean, who knew that that could be an academic pursuit?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I would say when you think about Marx and reading Marxist writings, it is... Well, at least for me, it is a different task altogether to read it once and then to interpret and to understand what the heck that essay is about. And that is generally our approach towards academic writing, that it is serious. It has to be serious, right? But you're bringing in a flair of fancy. It is, like you said, you had fun writing it. And there is capacious imagination, you know, in bringing these two worlds together. So is this really your approach to, you know, writing, like academic writing in general, or is it a tradition that you're trying to bring into your writing?
I mean, I don't know what it would be for other people. It's an interesting question. I think that, you know, the book was published by Duke University Press. They published my last book too. And if you look at the different editorial profiles of Duke, what their editors are looking for, many of them say that they're interested in books that speak between disciplines, that span disciplines. And I sort of wonder what the future of academic publishing is. Like, first of all, what is the ability of any particular academic discipline to reproduce itself? Well, in the discipline I'm in, English, it's not great. I mean, people retire and positions are not being filled. Graduate students are not getting jobs. So what does that do to the disciplines and the solidity of the disciplines? That's one question. Another question is, what happens to academic monographs when people no longer need them for tenure because people no longer get tenure because no longer tenure track jobs? I mean, there's such a relationship between academic publishing and a certain arc of a supposed academic career trajectory that many people no longer follow. I mean, they might want to follow it, but there's not an infrastructure there. And I sort of imagine, or I sort of wonder if Marx for Cats speaks to a kind of hope for a different academic publishing, not bound to disciplines, not bound to sort of the the same kind of career trajectories, not because it wasn't good and not because the disciplines weren't fruitful, but because there's the infrastructure that sustained them is disappearing. And so if that's the case, I mean, I'm a professor now. I don't need to write more books. I do it because I enjoy it. But if that is the case, like, what would we want of our publishing? I mean, many of us do deeply enjoy our research and deeply want to share it and have a community. But what does that community look like in a sort of para-academic form? And so I wanted a book that, you know, my hope for the book, I mean, I will only know this based on people's reaction, but my hope for the book is that people with a background, theoretical background in Marxism, economic background, could read and enjoy the book, and people who didn't have that and wanted it could get something from it. And that, and in a way, it would be not only an interdisciplinary book, but a book that doesn't require a theoretical specialty to really get something out of thinking about our current ecology in a moment of crisis and what the relationship is between human and non-human animal life in this particular conjuncture. And that's, you know what, that's a hard enough topic. Like, why not have fun doing it? Like, why not have fun producing that kind of work? Why not have fun reading about it? Again, I don't know, because the book is just out, you know, a few weeks. But that was my hope for it.
Yeah.
This episode is brought to you by Saks.com. At Saks.com, it's easy to find your new vibe. Dive into the Western trend with gold cowboy boots from Staud, or go full 90s throwback with platforms from Prada. You can shop for everything on your agenda, whether it's a breezy Zimmermann dress for a garden party or a bright Chloe blazer for brunch. Find inspiration for your new vibe every day at Saks.com.
So let's talk more about the book. So some of the takeaways for me was, one was about the, you know, the symbolism of the Feline symbolism in language, in politics, economy, culture. I mean, even as I was reading it, I was like aware of the number of symbolism or number of symbols and metaphors we have in the language itself, right? In the English language, and how it appears as you make it clear through, you know, various examples, like the British Empire and the lion, for example, or the Black Panther that you just mentioned about. And it is actually asking us to focus on this interspecies relationship or the coexistence of humans and animals in the environment, right? And to think beyond the Anthropocene. So, well, my broad question for you is, what is the advantage of thinking about economic history through cats, or thinking about cats through Marx or economic history?
Yeah, it's a great question. I think a little bit it depends on where you're coming from as a reader, right? So my sort of ultimate utopian fantasy for this book would be anybody who likes cats is a potential ally in an interspecies Marxism, right? That's the Sally of the book. I mean, that's a sort of grand dream of the book, that all cat lovers are potential comrades. You know, that's the term I use in the book. I was really influenced by Jodi Dean and her thinking about the comrade. So that's one way to answer the question. Another way to answer the question, or another way to think about the question, is that, you know, I think probably since 2007, 2008, there really has been an emergent field. I mean, I don't know if we would yet call it a discipline. I don't think so. But of animal studies in the academy, whether this is animal studies as history, literary and cultural studies of animals, sociology of animals, anthropologists are just doing incredible work in animal studies. And in ways, I think maybe some of the most exciting work is coming out of anthropology in animal studies. But not so much in political economy, and not so much in Marxism. And not only are they not thinking about non-human animals, but there's actually almost a derision with which they intercept a question about what is the role of the non-human animal here? What is the role of Marxism in a climate crisis? Now this is starting to change even in the past 3 years since I've written the book. but still not really. There are questions of degrowth, of environmental scale, of fossil fuels, but like really, what does a political equality with non-human animals look like? I don't think that they're thinking about it, and they're absolutely averse to thinking about it. And in a way, I think they sort of intercept those kinds of questions as a joke. Like, are you serious? Do you really want me to think about that? And so part of the point of the book is to say, or the joke of the book, Marx for Cats, is to say, you're going to treat this question as a joke anyway, Marxism and animals, like, so let's make it a joke. But it's also, you know, with that moment, with that sort of satirical intent or the idea of that joke, there also is an absolutely genuine question to ask, which is, I see so many critical theorists, I see so many Marxists. In the book, I show that their love of animals goes back hundreds of years. They have these intimate, loving relationships with an animal with whom they are in a sort of ownership relationship toward, a pet. But that does not become a sort of model for a larger concept of political care and comradeship. How do we get from there to here, right? Like, how do we take so many people, Marxists and not, I mean, their genuine sort of love and delight for the animals with whom they share their domestic and intimate spaces, how do we turn that into a politics that is not about ownership, is not about, oh, they're my children, but is a sort of radical politics that says, look, we live in a moment of climate crisis, we live in a moment of environmental devastation, industrial animal agriculture is a huge part of that. I mean, you know, something like, I don't know, 40%, 38% of the world's landmass is given over to cattle farming and, you know, industrial animal husbandry. Like, how do we think about that from a Marxist perspective as something that needs to be abolished, right? That needs to be reconstructed. And I would include pet ownership in that too. I mean, that gets a lot of pushback. But let's at least have the thought, like, let's at least imagine what a different model would look like that would foreground a political economic analysis, a historical analysis, and one that takes seriously a commitment to non-human animals.
Yeah. And I was trying to find your quote, but you also referred to Engels and about being an omnivore and how it is related to subjecthood, I think.
Engels,
yeah.
Yes. Is there a question?
Yeah. So my question was about, you know, in between this pet ownership, and there is also this question of consumption that brings relationship between, you know, humans and animals, mm-hmm. in a very well contested site, right? Because there are people who are, I mean, like me, who love animals in general, but I also eat animals, and it's a very difficult place to be in when you talk about human-animal relationship. And it is interesting that, you know, Engels had, you know, mentioned about it in his work.
I mean, Engels, you know, I think the quote that you're thinking of is Engels and Marx. They have some terrible quotations on 19th century societies for the prevention of animal cruelty or vegetarianism. So Engels has this one quote where he says, and he's thinking of India. The country, the subcontinent, he's saying, vegetarian societies sooner or later seem to succumb to cannibalism. I mean, it's an obscene and insane quotation. But he is responding, they are responding to a moment in the 19th century, the late 19th century, when mostly bourgeois reformers and moralists begin to question industrial humanity's relationship to animals. And I think that, you know, yes, is there something suspicious and problematic about, you know, a factory owner in Manchester in the 1880s, like worrying about a particular street urchin while his whole business depends on the impoverishment of millions of people. Absolutely. Like, this is not saying that they were incorrect to reject a kind of bourgeois sentimentalism. But what I try to show in the book is that there's also a really different and radical history of human longing for a political emancipatory relationship to animals, which is not about particular animals, my dog, my cat, your bird, whatever, but a kind of species freedom that many, not necessarily Marxist always, although many of them, somebody like Angela Davis, somebody like Rosa Luxemburg, a radical anarchist like Louise Michel of the Paris Commune, Jacobin, John Oswald. I mean, there's an entire genealogy here of radical thinkers who were trying to reconstruct a freer society for more beings, not just human ones. And that's what I would like a contemporary Marxism to be in conversation with. Not, you know, or did you make your $25 tax deductible donation to the, you know, ASPCA for the year? No, they're right to make fun of that. But, you know, Engels' conception of freedom includes the line, humans will leap out of the animal kingdom into a world of freedom. Well, why do we need to leap out of that kingdom, right? What would it mean to share a freedom with them? Rosa Luxemburg, who was an incredible lover of cats, her own cat in particular, but all animals, she parrots this line. I mean, what do we need to get a bit more imaginative in thinking about animals is not something to escape from or to deride or to eat, but, you know, to share a comradeship with and a political community with.
Yeah. And you also mentioned that cats were a witness to historical events and they had access to domestic spaces, which kind of, I mean, it's, I felt like I was taking that for granted, you know, the access of animals in our domestic intimate spaces, especially cats and dogs, and then also rats and cockroaches and, you know, everything else. So what makes cats special? Why did you choose cats over dogs?
Yeah. Question. Yeah, I, as you can imagine, I get asked this question a lot. Like, could you write Marx for dogs, Marx for horses, Marx for frogs, Marx for rabbits, Marx for birds? By the way, Marx for birds, yes, you absolutely could do that. And I think the answer is there's a genuine answer, which is I really like cats and I have a lot of fun with them. And that's, you know, at a certain point, I think that's any researcher's answer is I liked researching this because I had, there's an aesthetic appreciation here about the moment, or the text or, you know, what have you. But in doing all of this research, as you can also imagine, I came across a lot of different animals. So cats are, some, you know, sometimes they're by themselves, sometimes they're in the company of other animals. And I don't want to make a sort of radical, like a universal claim or an ahistorical claim. But I have read that cats are among the most represented animals in human cultural production.
Yeah, as you show with all those
yes, yes. And then I would specify that and say, particularly where the economy is concerned, and that's what this book is about. And I think, you know, one of the interesting things about cats is their anti-authoritarianism, their sort of conniving ways, their perceived selfishness and inability to be taught or trained. That has meant many different economic things at many different moments in the history of capitalism and feudalism. But cats have always functioned as economic signifiers in this period, in this 1200-year period. Would it be different if we kept going back? I mean, if we went into Egypt, if we went into Rome? Yes, absolutely. Would it be different if this were a non-Western book? This is a very Eurocentric book. A Marx for Cats absolutely could be written in Southeast Asia by somebody who's a South Asianist. It would be an amazing book. It would be a very different book, right? So there, you know, there's a there's a there's a two-part answer to that question, which is they really are overrepresented economically, and I do really like them. But again, my relationship to how I would imagine that like and that preference has changed as a result of writing this book.
So my final question, because my area is film studies, about Cat and films, which I think would be like a, you know, a continuation of everything that you have covered. You have, I mean, your archives cover a lot of literature, cultural symbols and everything, but I was a little disappointed to not see any, you know, film references, but I understand because of the time period you have covered. Or did I miss?
Yeah, there's Chris Marker.
Oh, Chris Marker. Yeah, I enjoy his films. So one example that came to my head was Fuses, which is, again, it is an experimental film by Carol Schneeman. So it actually, you know, it is related to Cat as a witness to, you know, a sexual event. And then I also thought about Princess Carolyn in BoJack Horseman. But anyways, in Fuses, at least, the cat is a witness. The cat, the camera itself becomes the cat's eyes. And it is the cat's vision that we get as humans. So there is some kind of, even though it is through a machine and through imagination, there is still like a human-animal connection to witnessing a very intimate moment over there, which was something that came to my head when I was reading your book. Are there any other, you know, interesting cat stories from media that you wanted to include but could not? And I'm sorry, I missed the Chris Marker reference.
A Grand Without a Cat, you know, where he actually has this great line I quoted in the book where he says, a cat is always on the side of freedom or always suspicious of power. But it's a comment about Nixon, about Richard Nixon. So it's a wonderful, it's a wonderful moment. And the Carol Schneeman, yes, I knew that because I make reference to that in my previous book, Wages Against Artwork, when I write about animals and artists. There's so many. I mean, that's the answer. There's so many. And the book could have been, it could have been twice as long. I have 100 images. That was a compromise with the press. I could have had 200. It could be a whole book of cat images. I mean, it's genuinely such a rich subject area. Someone just sent me a quote this morning about Levi-Strauss talking about his cat. And I have this little section on post-structuralism and structuralism. And I didn't know that. And I mean, you know, as you can imagine, having published a book like that, now I'm just absolutely deluged with cat anecdotes of things that I missed or, you know, couldn't fit in or knew about. I think some of the more surprising ones, you know, Frederick W. Taylor, who essentially invents the engineering and automated processes for assembly line work through Fordism, works with Ford. Ford himself, who got his idea from watching industrial animal slaughter, but that's a different story. But he, you know, Taylorism is about repetition, like monotony and repetition, deadening of skill to produce the most objects in the shortest amount of time. He trained his cat like that. He came up with his cats named like that. So, you know, it's these odd little anecdotes that you're just reading, or the fact that Karl Marx's family surname is Katzenellenbogen, which means cat's elbow in German. And if you go to the Jewish cemetery today outside of Venice, Marx's ancestors are buried there and they all have cats on their graves. This is from the 15th and 16th century. I mean, there are just so many of these wonderful anecdotes. Yeah, I wish I could have included 5 more pictures of the Marx family grave filled with cats in Padua at the Jewish cemetery. But, you know, one has to work in the bounds.
Yeah. But I completely understand you being inundated with cat pictures and cat anecdotes now, because one thing that the book did for me was to, you know, start thinking about cats in a way that I have never thought about cats before. It is, like I said, oh, cats have access to domestic places, right? Like in my house, I don't own a cat, but we have like stray cats who would just walk in and walk out as they please. And They don't care for authority. They don't care for boundaries. They don't care for anything. They just, you know, come and leave as they please. And about representations of cats in, you know, cinema and popular culture as well. So in that way, I think the book is like marvelous. It is like igniting that thought about, cats.
Thank you. I mean, that's my hope. I said one hope for the book is that every cat lover becomes a Marxist. But the other is that people who are not attuned to cat references start seeing them everywhere, and that that becomes the beginning of a sort of, you know, Benjaminian associative political imagination. So I'm glad that it's worked on this one reader, at least.
Yeah, I think that's a good note to end our episode. And it was amazing talking to you about your book, reading your book, and then talking to the author about it. So thank you for taking time.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me. Thank you for reading it. It was really nice to be in conversation with you too.
Yeah, thank you. Have a great day.
Thank you.